Hello and welcome into this Wednesday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. Hi there, Mark Congleton here, your sometimes humble host for this hour of observation, insight, and absurdity. Welcome aboard. It's good to have you along today. Oh my gosh. It is the 20th day of May, 2020. And I hope you and yours are doing well. If your life has been fairly normal throughout the pandemic, congratulations to you. If not, hang in there. I have a feeling before long, things are going to be returning to as much normal as possible. And I hope that you, like I, are rejecting any claims of there needing to be a new normal. I don't think there needs to be a new normal. I was never normal to begin with. It is, as I said, the Wednesday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. And the reason for Tweety Bird is because Joe Biden has come up with a new nickname for President Trump. He calls him President Tweety. You just can't make this stupidity up, can you? President Tweety. Oh, my word. Sleepy Joe. Bless your heart. Lots to talk about today. There is a California city that is rebelling against the governor. There is a study about patients who've recovered from coronavirus. We may touch on that a little bit later on. There's some stuff I've had in the list for several days. I hope to get to, probably won't, but I hope to get to. You remember how there was the story early on about cruise ships and people being quarantined on cruise ships? There are still people on cruise ships. I don't know if you know this, but there are still people on cruise ships. We'll talk about that in a little while. And, Creepy Uncle Joe, the hole just keeps getting deeper for him. Hopefully we can discuss that for a little bit today, because I know you already don't believe that Joe Biden is a viable option for president, but there's just that just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. We'll look at it more in a little while. First up, yesterday, the day was basically just your average two studio day for me, until something went wrong. I finished everything up here, got the podcast uploaded, everything done as it needed to be done, and ushered myself out and hit the road. Had a recording session, did the podcast at the Dawson studio, at the Dawson Now studio, got that all squared away. And what I do at the end of those podcast sessions is I export everything that's been recorded to a thumb drive, and then bring that thumb drive back to my studio, do the final mix, and then I upload it. It's available now. What happened yesterday is actually live right now. You can go to DawsonNow.com to find that. But I got home, opened the door to the rest of the house and announced to the dog I was home. Hey, I'm home. I went to the studio and plug the thumb drive in to the edit machine, which is the monster computer that I just built, and loaded everything up and started to do the mix down. And there most of the stuff was not there. It finished the export process. It let me take the thumb drive. The computer at the other studio did. Everything was supposed to be there, and it wasn't. And so I had to get back in the car and drive to the far side of the planet again and go back into the studio and do the export again. Now, this time I actually went to the thumb drive and looked, because what it does is it creates a folder with all of the audio files. And I clicked on that folder and looked and said, yep, okay, we got audio. And then I ejected it and took off. And I just didn't look closely enough. Otherwise I would have noticed that it was missing the one huge file. It just had to be there. So I checked, I double checked, and I triple checked, and then brought it back home, and I finished the audio, the edit up around 5:30 or so, yesterday afternoon. So it ended up being a full day, a long day, running back and forth across town twice. And but I got it all done, everything handled, and it's all online now. So there we go. And I actually have my notes about what happens next. And so I've got some more work to do there. And this morning, I awoke to an email announcing that a website transfer has finally happened that I've been waiting for. And that domain has been transferred over under my control now, so I can finish working on the website that I have been working on for quite some time. Well, not finish. I can move forward on it. And that's cool news. I've already tried doing some work this morning, and I'm having some issues with transferring files between the two sites. But I'll get that squared away sometime today, and then everything will be hunky-dory. And, but then again, that will be my day after we get through here today. Rather than working with audio, I'll be working with the graphics and other stuff and doing a website build. But that's fine. Most of that's already built. We're just working on ways to make some other things happen. For example, can I just indulge myself for a couple of minutes here? Thanks. It's my show. The business owner I'm building the website for wants to be able to use Venmo for payments for services. And if you're not familiar with Venmo, Venmo is owned by PayPal. It is a service which the concept is very, very cool. Let's just say you go with some friends and you have pizza, right? You all go out together and you have pizza. Let's say there are five of you. And they bring the bill, and instead of saying, hey, can you split this up? You just say, hey, I got it. And you, let's say it's $50 for everybody. That's probably a little cheap for five guys and pizza and whatever. But let's say it's $50 for the sake of easy math. And you pay the $50 on your credit card, debit card, drop cash, whatever. And your buddies around the table, your other four friends, pull out their mobile phones, pull up their Venmo app, and send each one of them sends you their share, which would be $10. And in a few seconds, you look at your Venmo app and you've got the $40 in your hand, so to speak, and it applies to whatever, your bank account, your debit card, your credit card, whatever you have things tied to. So that's the idea for Venmo. That's basically what the whole thing was all about. Well, now people are using Venmo for all kinds of things. My wife and I, when we were refrigerator shopping over the weekend, we passed by a couple who had a trailer set up on the parking lot in front of a Home Depot? I think it was a Home Depot. And they were selling plants, like big potted plants, out of the back of this trailer. And I noticed as we passed by the trailer, the doors are swung wide open and propped open. He has a sign stuck on one of the doors that says, pay with Venmo, and it's got his Venmo handle, his Venmo name on the sign, so that people could walk up, they could buy their ficus or whatever they want to buy from him, they could pull out their mobile phone, open Venmo, and pay him for it using their mobile phone. Very cool. And so that's one of the things I'll be working on today, is finding a way to use Venmo on this particular business's website, which if you're on your mobile phone, that's fine, because Venmo is about to be exclusively a mobile app. They're not going to be using their website for processing. I don't know when that happens. I just know it is happening. And so if you have a website with a Venmo link on it, you might not be aware of that. So if you're getting payments through Venmo on your website, it's only going to work for mobile users in the very near future. Just FYI. Anyway, that's just a little slice of my life, stuff that I've been aware of. And so I'm through geeking with that. Back to serious stuff. Oh, my Lord. Joe Biden's situation just gets worse and worse. The problem with being a criminal is that eventually somebody's going to turn on the lights and reveal all of your dirty laundry. And what's happening now is that it's a fight, it's a struggle but people who are trying to uphold the law are turning on the lights. And room by room in this big house of corruption, we're seeing the dirty laundry laying everywhere. It's been a long time. It's been long known that Joe Biden admitted to the quid pro quo already. We know about this. He bragged about him. There's video evidence. But there's some newly leaked audio, which was posted to YouTube, that lets us know Biden pushed for the ouster of Ukrainian prosecutor General Shokin, despite there being no evidence of wrongdoing against him. Quote, during this call, this is from Ukrainian President Poroshenko. He was the president then. During this phone call between Biden and the Ukrainian president, he says, "Yesterday I met with the general prosecutor Shokin." Biden acknowledges, yes. Poroshenko says, "And despite the fact that we did not have any corruption charges, we don't have any information about him doing something wrong, I asked him to resign." Poroshenko then explained that despite the fact Shokin had the support of parliament, that he was able to get Shokin to give a statement of resignation, which he provided to Poroshenko an hour later. "Great," Biden says. Poroshenko says, "This is my second step of keeping my promises." To which Biden replies, "I agree." Now, Biden said he was simply carrying out the official policy of the Obama administration to root out corruption in Ukraine. Quote, "It was a fully transparent policy carried out in front of the whole world and fully embraced by the international community of democracies." But that explanation is undermined by this recording. Since then, Ukrainian President Poroshenko admitted in the phone call they had nothing on Shokin in terms of corruption. Shokin's only crime seems to be that he was investigating Burisma Holdings, where Joe's son, Hunter Biden, served on the board, reportedly making over $80,000 a month. It's actually $83,000 and some change. Shokin has previously claimed that Poroshenko told him not to investigate Burisma because it was not in the best interests of Joe and or Hunter Biden. According to Rudy Giuliani's notes of his meeting with Shokin, quote, "Mr. Shokin was called into Mr. Poroshenko's office and told that the investigation into Burisma and the managing director where Hunter Biden is on the board has caused Joe Biden to hold up $1 billion in U.S. aid to Ukraine." Now, do you get this? Do you see, according to the notes of the meeting, this was the reason for the termination? According to Mr. Shokin? In a separate call, Biden can be heard congratulating the then-Ukrainian president for installing a new prosecutor general and then explaining to him that the billion-dollar loan can move forward. Biden said, "And I'm a man of my word, and now the new prosecutor general's in place. We're ready to move forward to signing that $1 billion loan guarantee." The leaked audio was posted to YouTube yesterday. Authenticity hasn't been verified, but there it is. According to Shokin, after he was fired, no active investigation into the offenses concerning the company Burisma Holding Limited, Cyprus, was carried out, and therefore, the persons implicated in these offenses were not identified, nor arrested or charged. It's his contention that because of Biden, Burisma and his son Hunter were off the hook. This leaked audio raises significant questions. Biden has insisted that the ouster of Shokin was simply him carrying out official policy of the Obama administration to root out corruption in Ukraine. This audio proves Shokin had no allegations of corruption against him and had the confidence of the Ukrainian parliament. If rooting out corruption was the Obama policy, but Shokin was admittedly not corrupt, was Biden acting alone in making the firing of Shokin a condition of the billion-dollar loan and not acting under the authority of President Barack Obama? This is a question which must be asked. It is a question which must be answered. More information is bound to be coming out. As people who are truly seeking to uphold the rule of law in America do their due diligence. and do their digging and seek the truth about the situation, I'm fairly certain that we will learn more about the corruption of the Obama administration. And we will learn more about Joe Biden and how his family seems to be connected to other stories like this one. We've already seen examples. When you look at the life of Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, you have to ask the question, how does somebody with this type of character get the sweet job, the sweet gig he did, and make all that money? Welcome back. It's the Daily Perspective Podcast for Wednesday, the 20th of May, 2020. 5-20-20. Good to have you along today. Thanks for making this part of your day. Regardless of when and where, and sometimes how you may be listening. You may be in the car, you may be at work working on a task, you may be on a walk, doubling the speed so you can get through it quickly. You know who you are. But thank you so much. I appreciate you being there. I really do. And I didn't pick this particular piece of bumper music for you. It just happened to be in the rotation. Anyway, let's move along here. On May 7th, the Department of Justice filed a motion to dismiss the case against former Trump National Security Advisor, retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. As the Associated Press put it, one of the signature cases brought by the special counsel, Robert Mueller, after a considered review of all the facts and circumstances of this case, including newly discovered and disclosed information. Among that newly disclosed information was evidence that the interview upon which the case was built was a perjury trap, as described by Attorney General William Barr. But the federal judge overseeing the case, Judge Emmett Sullivan of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, has refused to accept the Justice Department's motion to dismiss the case, tabling the motion, and instead opening the case up for amicus briefs from interested parties, a move which has been blasted by Flynn's legal team as a travesty of justice. Among those invited to file amicus briefs is the legal team that Flynn fired, and who has since been accused by his new attorneys of advising him while in the grip of intractable conflicts of interest. But, as reported by CBS News investigative correspondent Catherine Herridge, Judge Sullivan's opening up of the case has also drawn responses from over a dozen attorneys general who have signed an amicus brief calling on the judge to support the Justice Department's motion to dismiss without commentary, quote, because such punditry disrobes the judiciary of its cloak of impartiality, end quote. Attorneys general from 15 states, Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Texas, Utah, and West Virginia, filed the briefing to the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia Monday, in support of the United States, and arguing that the court lacks authority to exercise judgment over a decision that constitutionally belongs to the executive branch. The argument of the attorneys general aligns with arguments made by Flynn's legal team, which has called for the immediate dismissal of the case. Flynn attorney Sidney Powell wrote in a court filing responding to Sullivan's decision to shelve the Justice Department's motion and reopen the case, this travesty of justice has already consumed 3 or more years of an innocent man's life and that of his entire family. No further delay should be tolerated or any further expense caused to him and his defense. This court should enter the order proposed by the government immediately. In the filing, Powell, who Flynn acquired after dismissing his initial legal team, which advised him to plead guilty to lying to the FBI, pointed out that, quote, this court has consistently, on 24 previous occasions, summarily refused to permit any third party to inject themselves or their views into this case. Attorney General Barr has made clear where Justice Department stands on the case, calling for the dismissal of the case and condemning the charges against Flynn as being the result of a perjury trap laid by James Comey's FBI. In an interview on CBS News back on May 7th, Attorney General Barr explained the DOJ's rationale, saying, "It's on the question of materiality that we feel really that a crime cannot be established here because there was not, in our view, a legitimate investigation going on. They did not have a basis for counterintelligence investigation against Flynn at that stage based on a perfectly legitimate and appropriate call he made as a member of the transition." Asked by Herridge if the counterintelligence case against General Flynn was simply left open to lay a trap for lying, Attorney General Barr said, "Yes." He goes on to say, "I think a very important evidence here, it was that this was not a bona fide counterintelligence investigation. Was they were closing the investigation in December. They started that process. And on January 4th, they were closing it. They initially tried some theories of how they could open another investigation, which didn't fly. And then they found out that they had not technically closed the earlier investigation, and they kept it open for the express purpose of trying to lay a perjury trap for General Flynn." So, the FBI did not have a basis for counterintelligence investigation. Not at that stage. Not based on a perfectly legitimate and appropriate call he made as a member of the transition. We've recently seen, in the last 24 hours, actually, we have seen unredacted, now formerly redacted, portions of Susan Rice's memo to herself, which in itself was fishy. Do you write a memo to yourself to remind yourself of anything before moving on to a different job? Do you do that unless you're trying to cover yourself for something? No. No, you don't. Innocent, upstanding, right-thinking, decent, honest people don't have to do things like that. They just don't. But we know from what has been revealed from that Comey said that Flynn's contact with Russia during the transition was suspicious, because he sure had been talking to those people a lot, essentially what he was saying. And the mainstream press, the progressive press, has been making much of that. And they've been ignoring a key factor in this. That was Flynn's job. It was his job to be in contact with these other countries. And the frequency of the calls could be more or less depending on things that were hanging in between in the transition period between two administrations. So his need to communicate frequently or infrequently with any other representative of any other country would depend on what was happening with that country or not happening with that country. It just so happens that there were some things going on, hanging in limbo during the transition, and so there was some talk. Yes, General Flynn talked with people in Russia because it was his job to do so, and what he talked about pertained to the transition and what they needed to get clear as the transition occurred. In fact, General Flynn said to the FBI during that questioning, "You have the phone call. You know what I said. You know what was said." He kept saying, he said to them, "You have the phone call." So he knew that they had the recording of the call. He knew they had listened to the call. He knew they had the transcript of the call. He knew all of this, and he knew his job. As I discussed last week with you, the reason Flynn was fired by the Obama administration was not because he was incompetent. It was not because he wasn't trustworthy. It was not because he wasn't honest. It was not because he didn't do his job. Flynn was fired by the Obama administration because he was honest, he was trustworthy, and he was doing his job. And in doing his job, he was about to reveal things they were doing, which were illegal. Flynn was fired by the Obama administration because he was a threat. And if he revealed the illegal activity they were involved with, it would have undermined their claims to being the only administration with zero problems, zero trouble. They were so squeaky clean that you couldn't find anything wrong about what they did. They were scandal-free. That was the term I was searching for, a scandal-free administration, which in itself was a lie because there are so many things which were documented. I have, in the last couple of weeks, I've told you about 200 things. Yeah, 200 ways the Obama administration broke U.S. law. Just completely and flagrantly ignored it and did whatever they wanted to do. And Flynn, being the honest guy that he was, being the Boy Scout, was dangerous to the Obama administration. And so they fired him. And when it came time for the transition to take effect and Trump had chosen him to serve under his administration, Obama couldn't leave that alone because he knew Flynn would reveal his corruption. Welcome back. It's the Daily Perspective Podcast for Wednesday, May 20th, 2020. Sorry, I was taking a quick sip of coffee there. Skimming through social media, as I usually do in the breaks, and lost track of the time, and all of a sudden, whoa, we're back. Oh, my, my. Let's see, what else is there? There's talk right now, a lot of talk right now, about bailing out these blue states that are all in financial trouble. And as more of the information comes out about what they're asking for, the more obvious it is that they are trying to get you and I, who live in states which are not, and you may not live, you may live in a blue state and not be happy with the way they've done business and the fact that they've run up deficits and that they're budgeting. I mean, they budget like a toddler with a credit card. But we're seeing that that's exactly what's been happening, is that they have adopted these progressive ideas and they have funded things and started programs without funding, and they have established pension plans which can't be funded. When you actually, here's a little homework for you if you've never looked into this. Look at government pensioning and union pensioning and look at how those funds work, and look at how they're supposed to be paid for in theory on paper. And then juxtapose that with the real world and how the real world works. Because in the real world, after a certain amount of time, those pension programs become unfundable because they just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. But those people who establish those funds and defend those funds will tell you, you just don't understand how this works. Or if you do understand how this works, and you tell them, well, wait a minute, I know how this works because one, this, and two, this, and three, this, and four, this. And when you combine that and when you look at all of these other factors that are involved and the economy, yada, 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 and they realize you do know what you're talking about, they then accuse you of being some sort of a hate monger. Well, you're a racist. You don't want these union members are mostly black. You know, you hate black people, right? And that's what will happen. But I encourage you to do your homework. Because these union pensions and government pension plans, they're pie in the sky dreams is what they are. It's no wonder people want to have a pension plan from a union or for a government job, because in those plans, they can literally make more money in retirement than they made in their entire lives working. And if you don't think that's true, go look it up. But right now, we're seeing that these blue states, which have been idiotic with their finances, are now expecting red states to be happy with helping dig them out of the hole that they dug themselves before the coronavirus. They were in trouble before coronavirus. That means when coronavirus hit, they were in much, much deeper kimchi. And now they're expecting us to just help wipe out their issues, including the ones created by their stupidity before coronavirus. And there are people in government, right-thinking, honest people, who are standing up and saying, no, this can't happen. And hopefully, some of those people work for you and your state. Speaking of COVID-19, the coronavirus, I mentioned at the top of the show about cruising, about cruises and such. And we know that there were people who were trapped on cruise ships, and it was an ordeal for some of them to get off. And I actually watched some videos by a couple who told of their ordeal. They booked like a 2-week cruise, and they were on the cruise ship for over a month, and they went from port to port to port. They were in the South Pacific and ended up going to all kinds. They were going someplace and ended up getting rerouted to Australia because where they were going closed. So no outsiders, can't come here. And then Australia, by the time they got to Australia, Australia closed their ports. And then they kept getting refueled and going different places. And they wound up in Hawaii, and Hawaii said, nope, can't come here. And they ended up somewhere in California before they could finally get off the boat. Well, did you know that more than 2 months after the pandemic shut down the cruise industry, there are still more than 100,000 people on cruise ships? Crew members, they're still stuck on ships. They have no idea when they're going to get home. And with some of them not getting paid. The Miami Herald is reporting this. During this time, 578 crew members on various ships have been diagnosed with COVID-19. 7 have died from the disease. Two crew members actually jumped overboard in apparent suicides. Crew members on a Royal Caribbean cruise went on a hunger strike for more than 72 hours in an attempt to get the company to let them go home. A crew member who works in the retail department on a Carnival cruise ship named Gan Sungralingam. That sounds like something that Bill Murray would say that the... Never mind. he says he hasn't been on land in more than 2 weeks, according to the Herald. The ship dropped off its last passengers in Florida March 14th. That's a month ago. He hasn't been paid since April 12th. His home country, Mauritius, is not allowing citizens to come home. They've locked the doors. Nope, can't come back here. Not bringing your cooties here. This crew member compared the time on the ship to prison. He eats meals in a dining hall, spends his days either in his passenger room or in the gym during his allotted time slot. The cruise companies say complications with government rules of various nations are the reason so many crew members have been stuck on ships. Ports around the world are closed. Countries have varying travel restrictions. Although the International Labor Organization, a UN organization, has recommended that crews at least get sick pay during the pandemic, many crew members say that hasn't happened. The Herald says Norwegian Cruise Line Holdings, MSC Cruises, and Disney Cruise Line crew who are no longer working on board say they're not getting paid. Royal Caribbean crew say they're receiving $400 a month. Carnival Cruise Line crews say they're being paid 60 days past the end of their contract. Crew on other Carnival Corporation brand ships like Princess Cruises say they're not being paid. Norwegian Cruise Line crews say they've not been paid since the end of March. The company didn't respond to requests for comment about the issue. Michelle Habib of Romania, who works for the Bahamas Paradise Cruise Line, said, I pay rent for my parents and sister. I need to go home to work. Well, I understand that if you're off the ship, you're not on the cruise line's property, and they have furloughed people, I understand not getting paid. That's happening here in all kinds of businesses where people are being told, we're sorry, we have to cut back to a skeleton crew. We have to close the doors. Nobody can come in. And since we have nothing coming in, nobody's frequenting our business, we have no money. We can't pay you. So here you go. Go get your unemployment. And I understand that happening. That actually makes sense. Whose fault is that? It's not the business's fault. It's government's fault for slamming the door for being able to produce income. It's the government's fault. So I understand how that happens. Excuse me. So I don't really have a problem with that. But the people who have been stuck on board, those people who can't get home because of the quarantines from their countries, that's a problem. That's a problem. The countries are responsible for that, but at the same time, well, they are being fed every day. They have a place to stay every day. I still think possibly there should be some way to help, because these people really are victims of circumstance, and something has to be done to help. And if their countries aren't helping, then the country slammed the door on them. And it's not actually, I don't think it's the cruise line's fault, the cruise line's responsibility. I think it's actually the responsibility of the government of their home nations, who will not allow them to come home. And those governments, the experts, the elites, these people who are smarter and better than everybody else and know what's best for everybody, those people who slammed the door on their citizens, those people should be responsible for making sure that they can pay their bills and feed their families, because they're the ones who made the decision to trap these people so they couldn't provide for their families. It's a sad situation. Jane and I were actually shopping for a cruise right before this all happened. We were looking at going on a cruise we'd never been on. We've been on a handful of cruises, and we were looking at a possibility of taking a Southern Caribbean or Western Caribbean cruise and going some places we've never been before and seeing some Aztec ruins and just enjoying life, having things brought to us. You know, you go sit down and they bring stuff to you. You pick up the phone, they bring stuff to you. You sit and just watch the world go by, enjoy the sea breeze and get out and explore local places and just completely unplug from everything for a little while, which is what's great about cruises. And one of my favorite things is that your cell phone very often doesn't work. So it's not dinging all the time and bothering you, and you really do unplug. And that's what we were hoping to do, because we have that opportunity. I mean, it's set aside for us. We just have to decide where we're going to go. And then we started hearing about this virus, and I decided, I think I'm going to wait. Really glad I did. Really glad I did. Because who knows what could have happened had we been somewhere along the Mexican coast in the Gulf of Mexico and the cruise line announced, hey, we're pulling the plug on everything. We need to get you back on board, and we're getting out of here. And then find out when we get home we can't get off the ship. Think about that. I also thought about possibly getting on a plane and going places. And the more I thought about that, the more stupid the idea became. So we decided just to hold off. We still haven't made a decision about what we're going to do. We can't. But hopefully that will change soon. More after the break, when the Daily Perspective continues. Welcome back. to the Daily Perspective. Good to have you along. Thanks for listening. And thanks for sharing the podcast. I appreciate that. There's a study that's in the last couple of days has come out. I think it was released the day before yesterday. It finds evidence that patients who test positive for the coronavirus after recovering are not capable of transmitting the infection, coupled with research showing that recovered patients have the antibodies that prevent them from falling sick again, and researchers may finally be able to say that people who've recovered from COVID-19 infection are no longer a risk to catch or spread the virus. Scientists from the South Korean CDC studied 285 COVID-19 patients who tested positive after they'd recovered, as well as 790 people who had come into contact with them. The so-called re-positive patients weren't found to have spread any infection, and virus samples collected from them could not be grown in culture. The results confirmed what scientists had suspected. Patients who test positive after recovering from COVID-19 have not become reinfected, but instead are simply shedding non-infectious or dead virus particles, which can lead to a false positive test. The new study has led health authorities in South Korea to revise their protocols, saying people should no longer be required to test negative for the virus before returning to work or school after they've recovered from their illness and completed their period of isolation. The news is a good sign for regions that have had a high percentage of their population already infected and recovered. However, it may still be too early to recommend a herd immunity approach to responding to the outbreak. Without an accurate estimate of the virus's infection fatality rate, it's not impossible to estimate how many people would die if the virus is allowed to spread through the population in order to build up the population's immunity. If, for example, if the infection fatality rate is 0.5% and 70% of the population must become infected before herd immunity is established, that means roughly 1.2 million Americans would die in the process. However, few, if any, people are arguing that the virus should be allowed to spread with no protections in place. Instead, most proponents of a herd immunity approach argue that the most vulnerable population, the elderly and infirm, should be strictly protected, while those less at risk should be allowed to return to their normal lives. Still, without a more accurate infection fatality rate figure, it's difficult to model how that approach would compare to the current lockdown approach, and the highly politicized nature of the debate over reopening makes it very unlikely that any sort of Swedish approach would be tried in the United States. Regardless, this new study is great news for areas looking to open up as more patients recover from COVID-19, showing that those who have recovered present no risk of spreading the coronavirus when physical distancing measures are relaxed. So this is a good news story. And of course, the progressive press will find ways to undermine it and to make it a bad news story. But the fact remains, South Korea has actually been doing this study, working on finding answers, and they're finding answers. And finding out the answer, this answer that people who have recovered from the coronavirus but still test as having it in their systems are not infecting other people, is a meaningful discovery. And it's something that we need to file away and remember, because we're discovering more and more here in the United States that a lot more people have been exposed and have actually had coronavirus. They've gone through the COVID-19 experience, and we're basically no worse for the wear. That's what the testing is discovering, is that people have already had it, a lot more people than we thought, and they're okay. And when they start doing all the math and taking that into consideration, the morbidity rate drops drastically. But since fear and manipulation are the tools of the progressives in government and in the press, you won't see any sunny outlooks coming from those people. You know, I've talked about this before. In the media, there's this old saying that says, if it bleeds, it leads. And I was interested that Leon Wolf over at The Blaze included that particular phrase in his story, called Most of the Media is Trying to Keep Us Shut Down Forever with Absurd Unscientific Fear-Mongering. He's saying what I've been saying. He says, you know the old saw about how the media works? If it bleeds, it leads. That's maybe less true than it used to be, but it's still generally true that the media feeds on panic and bad news. There's no ratings in a story that says, everything is fine, go about your business, and you'll almost definitely be okay. The media's addiction to panic is the source of a lot of terrible public policy. They even have a term for it, moral panic. A lot of the idiotic laws that criminalize trivial behavior and interfere with the economy and individual freedom in unnecessary ways are the fault of the media's addiction to it. Usually, the stakes aren't tremendously high, at least for the public at large. Apple growers and sellers were temporarily devastated by the Alar panic, but most of us just kind of went on with our lives. The current crisis, which is becoming the biggest moral panic in the history of the universe, is different. I noticed today that a story from Business Insider that featured the screaming headline, France recorded 70 new coronavirus cases in schools a week after it let more than 1 million kids go back to class. The article favorably quotes from anonymous European parents who are mad that their kids are being used as guinea pigs and scolds French Education Minister Jean-Michel Blanquer for calling the 70 positive test results out of 1.4 million children inevitable. Let's start by stating the obvious. The reporter who wrote this story didn't bother to even do a cursory job of coming to grips with the science of coronavirus transmission before writing the story. Given what we know about the virus's incubation period, the chances that any of these 70 cases, which popped up, by the way, in 7 days, came from school transmission? Extremely small. Extraordinarily small. There's a possible story that could be written in 2 or 3 weeks about school transmission of the coronavirus in France, but to write a story like this after 7 days means you either didn't know or don't care about the subject at hand. And as long as you can scare people, that's what matters. Second, yes, it's inevitable that some kids are going to get the coronavirus when schools reopen. There is literally nothing that can be done to stop this. Even if schools never reopen or don't reopen for 18 months while we wait for a vaccine, there will still be some in-school transmission of coronavirus. The overwhelming majority of these kids will show no or very mild symptoms. Yes, a very small number of them will develop multi-system inflammatory syndrome, which itself is treatable but can be fatal if left untreated. Here's something any parent who has small kids already knows. Sending your kids to any school is an invitation for them to catch a disease. The vast majority of these diseases will come and go, but sometimes, in rare cases, it will be something serious, or it will be something that is normally not life-threatening, like hand, foot, and mouth disease or strep throat, but can become serious or even fatal in rare cases, like multi-system inflammatory syndrome with coronavirus. There is literally no way to avoid this, other than to have at least one parent stay at home and homeschool, which does not eliminate the risk of infectious disease, but certainly reduces it. Of course, we are regularly told by liberals and the media that homeschooling is bad and should not be encouraged. But apparently the media's insatiable demand for panic trumps even their disdain for homeschooling and their insistence that everyone must go to government-funded public school. One might get the impression, from the tenor of the coverage, that the majority of the media wants us all to stay home forever, scared of venturing outside, and constantly checking our phones for the latest dose of panic from the media. Their coverage certainly seems intended to have that effect. Kudos to Leon Wolf at The Blaze. He just nails it. Absolutely nails it. He mentions multi-system inflammatory syndrome a couple of times. It's a story that's popped up with that pearl-clutching, gasping, oh my God, this is how COVID-19 is affecting children. Wait a minute. Children! Yes, but what I have seen, the instance of this actually happening, has been very, 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 very low. And one story I saw seemed to blame COVID-19, even though the test group of children they were talking about, a third of them developed this. And then they blamed it on COVID-19, even though there wasn't anything to show it was tied to COVID-19. They just happened to happen at the same time. There's still a lot we need to learn about that. But that doesn't matter to the mainstream press. No, no, no. Remember, if it bleeds, it leads. And if it's scary, it drives up their ratings and increases their revenue. That's it for today. God bless you. Have a good one. We'll see you back here tomorrow for the next edition of The Daily Perspective. Bye-bye.
Oh, we're done.